through 21. From whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might through his Holy Spirit in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and length and depth and height, to know the love of Christ which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with the fullness of God. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, to him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. There were some technical difficulties, but if you were live, you heard the opening prayer. Finally. And so pray each week for the speaker as well as for the equipment, I guess you could say. Speaking of technical difficulties and equipment, I'm wearing my Star Trek tie today in honor of the Orion. We live near the space coast. We live just minutes away from the activity here of NASA in the United States. So it's nice to know that our space program is back on track. And Linda and I are preparing to celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary by having a second honeymoon on Mars. I'm kidding, but maybe you don't know that a cousin of mine was in on this project to launch this rocket. My cousin, Nose Cohen. Another groaner. Ladies and gentlemen, today I want to talk about some of the heroines of the Bible. There are many. I only have time for three today. Particularly, I'm going to focus on two. Let's remember these wonderful women. I want to begin by going to 2 Corinthians 11. What is my job when I'm not teaching English as a second language? In the ministry, think of yourselves collectively. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, think of yourselves collectively as the church, as the bride of Christ. You are betrothed. And after the betrothal, you are committed. You now must be faithful to your husband to be, your fiancé. He has not yet come to consummate the marriage. He is coming. And my job as a minister is to keep you focused on your fiancé and not to have you get interested in anyone else. I want to go to 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. Paul says to the church at Corinth, "For I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ." So this is my role, the shadchan, the matchmaker. Well, I'm not really the matchmaker. That's been done. But in some cases, I can be. I hope to be for many. Maybe many more can be brought to relationship with God through this ministry. I certainly hope and pray that's the case. Many hundreds, many thousands, or millions, however it works out. But in the meantime, it is my job to protect those of you who have made this commitment, to keep the commitment until the coming of the groom. So we, the church, collectively are the bride of Christ. We are the pure, chaste woman whom Christ will marry at his return. Today I want to talk about three wonderful women. Let's remember these three wonderful women. I go back to very ancient times, to the days of the judges. I want to remember today Deborah, Jael, and Abigail. Deborah, Jael, and Abigail. Two of them were at the time of the judges. One of them was at the time of the first king of the United Monarchy, Saul. And I'm not going to spend as much time with Deborah. She's also probably a more familiar figure. Deborah and let's go to chapter 4. And let's back up a little bit and get some background here. Israel sinned. Israel was oppressed. That's the story in the Judges period. This is in more the northern part of the country here. And so they're under the tyrannical rule of a Canaanite ruler who who's oppressing them. And at this time, the men of Israel were not really standing up and being men, not exercising really their manly prerogatives to be leaders. So we did have a prophetess. Now, prophetesses are in the Bible, throughout the Bible, and their role is to advise the leadership. God speaks directly to these prophetesses, and then they give the message to the leaders. They're special advisors to the kings of Israel or to the ministry in the New Testament church. And there will be a time when we will have prophetesses again. We don't have them now, to my knowledge. I wouldn't advise any of you to volunteer for that. When it comes, you'll know. But in any case, here was a prophetess, but she was more than that. In this case, she was also managing things, running a part of the nation, judging, administering. Now, Deborah, prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. So that would be, frankly, that's an indication that there really wasn't any qualified man to do it. For her to advise. So she had to basically take the reins. They backed away and let her do it. And she did it. She did it well. And she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. They knew she was the one to go to. She was in that part of the nation, the leader. Then she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh and Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the eternal God commanded of Israel?" Remember, she was a prophetess. She was a judge at this time, but she had that special gift of prophecy, which Barak did not. Now, Barak should have been more of a leader, but as I said, he sort of hung back and let Deborah do the leading. "Has not the eternal God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor, take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun. And against you, I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and the multitude at the river Kishon." This is near Mount Carmel. "And I will deliver him into your hand." This is a promise from God that now the oppression will end through the prophetess Deborah, who's also a judge. She's telling Barak, by the way, this is Barak meaning lightning. The word for blessed in Hebrew is Baruch, and that's also a name. And in Arabic, evidently, the name is Barak. So the President of the United States, his name in Arabic, Barak, is like the name Baruch. So it's not the Barak here. Barak here means lightning, so it's not the same Barak. Anyway, this is not Barak Obama. This is Barak of Naphtali. Anyway, verse 7. "And against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's..." Did I confuse people then?
No.
Okay, good. "And against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. And Barak said to her, 'If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go.'" So he just didn't have the confidence to do it on his own, even though the prophetess said, "God says do it!" "But no, you have to be there," he said. Now, she was not pleased with that response because she felt like he ought to have enough faith to just go do it. Why drag her to a battle scene? You know, she's a female. She doesn't want to be in a battle scene. I guess nowadays there are some women who want to do that and so on in this current culture. But back in those days, it wasn't a woman's place to be out there on the battlefield. And so she said, "No, God says through me you'll do it, so do it." And he said, "No, I won't do it if you don't come." So she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey that you are taking. For the Eternal will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." So in that culture, and probably even today in the Arabic culture of the Middle East and the Persian culture, to be defeated by a woman, for a man to be defeated by a woman in battle, is a rather dishonorable fate, dishonorable destiny. And so she says, "Okay, I'll go with you, but the glory is going to be to a woman who's going to defeat this general." Well, how's that going to work out? Well, she was a prophetess. Obviously, he couldn't figure out how that was going to happen, but she knew it was going to happen. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. I'm not going to read too much more about this. I just want to remind us about the greatness of Deborah. And how she, in effect, tried to inspire Barak to be the man he needed to be. And when she couldn't do that, then of course she went there and as a team, they were successful, of course, as God had inspired her to prophesy. And so Sisera, the general, fled the scene. Verse 15. And the Eternal routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. So this was really a great defeat, but the general was still alive, and he needed to be defeated. The enemy needed to be crushed. They were a very vicious enemy, and I guess there was the possibility they could try to regroup and come back. So the decisive victory was needed, including the vanquishing of the general himself. So let's go on to verse 17. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. Heber, or in American English, Heber, I guess this is called Americanized Hebrew. Heber the Kenite was not an Israelite. And he was on good terms with the Israelites, but he also was on good terms with the Canaanites. He was just there, you know, basically living as a Bedouin on the margin of society. He wasn't part of the cities of Israel, and he wasn't a Canaanite, but he was at peace with both sides. He was, you know, a Bedouin on the margin of civilization, living neutrally there. And his wife, Yael, perhaps she was Israelite, she had a Hebrew name. And Yael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear." And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. So he was perhaps traumatized, he was certainly exhausted, and perhaps wounded. I don't know if it says that, but rather traumatized. And so she's, in effect, giving him the kind of care you would somebody in that state. Well, his whole army's been wiped out, so he must be devastated emotionally. Then he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a jug of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him. I think that the idea of giving him milk was to even seem more hospitable, but also perhaps it might make him drowsy. I think maybe a glass of milk has that characteristic. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there any man here?' you shall say, 'No.'" So he did fear for his life, obviously. He was on the losing end. Then Yael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. So indeed, this woman was able to figure out a way to deal with the man. Not a face-to-face confrontation, but she dealt with him as appropriate to a wicked murderous oppressor, so he died. So she, in that sense, was a hero. She was taking the gamble. What if he had awakened? He still very likely would have had enough strength to deal with her. She was taking her life into her hands. Besides that, you know, her husband's situation is now different because his family has now become allied with Israel. But Israel are God's people, and the Canaanites were not supposed to be there. So she did the right thing. And then as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I will show you the man whom you seek." And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera dead with a peg in his temple. So Barak then understood, yes, Deborah was right, of course. Deborah said that I wouldn't be the one to deal with Sisera, it would be a woman, and that's what has happened. So now Sisera is now Yael is the heroine of the occasion, because she defeated the general in a very interesting way, and took great courage on her part, of course, as well as wit, cleverness on her part. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel, and the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. Then we have this beautiful poem, this hymn of Deborah and Barak that you find in chapter 5. And many scholars will look at this and acknowledge its ancient lineage. This goes back indeed to the period that we would define as the Judges period, and the period of the, even before the Homeric poetry of ancient Greece. So it's looked upon by liberal scholars as a great classic piece of work, as one of the oldest parts of the Bible from their point of view. And as I said, so Deborah was not only a prophetess, but she gave us, together with Barak, of course, great victory over the Canaanites, liberation and emancipation of her people, as well as this beautiful poetry, classic poetry and hymn that is here in the book of Judges, where there's a lot of important content to it. But I'm going to focus on Yael, because as I said, my focus today is on Deborah, and then I say Jael and Abigail, because the way we say it in English, they tend to rhyme. Yael and Abigail. So let's go to verse 24. Here we have an ode to Yael, the woman who risked her life to kill this king. Most blessed among women is Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Blessed is she among women in tents. He asked for water, she gave milk. She brought out cream in a lordly bowl. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Sisera, she pierced his head, she split and struck through his temple. I was going to say before I started this talk that this sermon today, I was wanting to warn the families that this sermon today is PG. There is graphic violence and rough language. The rough language you'll hear later. Right now you have the graphic violence. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Sisera, she pierced his head, she split and struck through his temple. At her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. Verse 31. Thus let all enemies perish, O Eternal, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. There may be some Israelis listening, so you may know the song. Kein yovedu, yovedu koloi becha. And you know, anyway, it comes from verse 31 here. Then let all your enemies perish, O Eternal, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. So the land had rest for 40 years. Now, we are New Testament Christians. We are non-violent, but we still can remember the example of Yael. Number one, she used her wits. We need to be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. We are vulnerable in this world. We're a persecuted minority. We are gentle people living in a very rough and tough world. So we do need to be wise, as I've been saying for weeks. You know, we do need to be very wise in our dealings with the world. We also need to have the courage of our convictions, as Yael had, and to live courageously. And also, there are times when we have to do very unpleasant things, but there are things that we need to do. They may be very inconvenient, very difficult. They may be messy. They may be time-consuming. I heard a very good sermonette a couple of years ago at the Festival of Tabernacles. The idea was, ask yourselves, you know, when you complete a day, have you done some service which was inconvenient, time-consuming, messy, perhaps costly? You know, have you done that kind of service? I'm not saying we should look for trouble. In fact, no, we don't look for trouble. We don't want trouble. But as I said, we need to be willing to have the wit, the wisdom, the faith, the conviction, the courage, and the dedication of a woman like Yael. What a wonderful woman. And she was part of this great victory over an oppressive, tyrannical, idolatrous nation, the Canaanites. Verse 31, thus let all your enemies perish, O Eternal, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. So the land had rest for 40 years. And as we know, eventually the Israelites wanted a monarchy, as the other nations had, and God chose their first king, Saul. Saul, unfortunately, didn't measure up. So God chose a man after his own heart, as the Bible says. He chose David, David HaMelech. David, of course, is now a great figure in history. His name means beloved, and beloved he is. Many people have the name David. My middle name is David. My grandson's middle name is David. I'm named after a great uncle, David. By the way, we're going to be having a family reunion possibly in a week or so, where I get to meet somebody whose grandfather was my great uncle. a cousin. You know, we're going to have a family reunion. We've not seen that cousin since 1982. Anyway, getting back to the account here, David is on the run, though he didn't deserve it. He has a group of people now following him. He is someday going to be king, but right now he's a fugitive. It's very much like if you've ever seen the series The A-Team. I guess that's getting ancient, but there was a movie made recently. Not that long ago? I mean, a long time ago now, huh? Decades ago? No, no, when was the A-Team movie made? In the 2000 or so? The A-Team movie.
Last five years.
So I don't know how the movie was, but the theme of the television series was like King David. Here were people who were good people. They were veterans. And they were accused of a crime they didn't commit. So they were on the lam. They had to leave, you know, they had to flee from the government. But while they were doing that, they did good deeds. And they righted wrongs all over the country, you know, while at the same time trying to stay one step ahead of the authorities. So, as I said, it seemed probably was based on David's career. There's a liberal rabbi out in Southern California. A lot of you who listen to me are living in Southern California, and I hope to be there, God willing, in the spring for the beginning of the holy day season there. But in Southern California, there's a famous liberal rabbi named David Wolpe, W-O-L-P-E. He, I think, still is a rabbi over one of the more influential congregations in what we call the Southland out there. And evidently, he's taken upon himself, maybe because his name is David, but anyway, he's taken upon himself to really study the life of King David. And he comes to it from a Jewish perspective, but from a liberal Jewish perspective. But anyway, he's become so well known. I think he wrote a novel or a book about David, either a book or an historical novel. Anyway, he's an advisor to a Hollywood movie, maybe two. There are two movies coming out on David fairly soon, and he's advisor to one or both of them. So anyway, you may be hearing talk of David because of the fact of these movies coming out and because of Rabbi David Wolpe. But I want to talk about David from the point of view of a wonderful woman who confronted him. As I said, today I'm talking about wonderful women. I want to talk about Abigail. Then Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him. I'm in chapter 25 of 1 Samuel. We have the death of Samuel. Saul is king now. Samuel has died now, and buried him in his home in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So you see, David is fleeing. Maybe he feels the situation is even worse now with Samuel dead. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. So this was, I suppose, spring of the year, and the time to shear the sheep. He was a wealthy man, and the name of the man was Nabal. Now, whenever you give a child a name in Hebrew, there could be more than one possibility for the name, but there's one negative meaning for Nabal. It means a fool. And it turns out that's what he turned out to be. So whatever positive connotation, we remember him now as Nabal, as a fool. So in America we would call him Nabal. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. And Abigail had a personality very much in a way like Abigail Adams, the first lady of our second president. The life of Abigail Adams is very interesting to study. When her family named her Abigail Adams, it was almost a prophecy of the kind of woman that she was going to be. It's very interesting, as I said, to study the relationship of John and Abigail Adams. Quite interesting. Anyway, let's go back to the Abigail in the Bible. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. So he was related to David in terms of being of the tribe of Judah. But surely did not live up to the standards of Caleb. Now, you'll find often that rich and successful people can you know, get the pick of the crop. He got a very good wife, and that's understandable. And she decided, once having committed herself to him for whatever the reason was, that she was indeed going to be a faithful wife. She was a virtuous woman, and she was going to be a faithful wife. Her husband was not you know, let's say, far less than the ideal, but she had made a commitment, and she was going to keep it. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing sheep, David sent 10 young men and said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, 'Peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have.'" You know, very friendly, very respectful, not making any demands. He had an army. He could have tried to make demands, but that's not what he did. Now I have heard that you have shearers, your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. David's troops actually protected Nabal. They represented security for him. They did him a service. And I suppose maybe they had in their mind, someday we'll need help, and he's a very rich and influential person. Someday we may need help, we're helping him, so maybe he'll help us. As you ask your young men, and they will tell you, therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. This was a special time of year, the time of the sheep shearing, which was a festive time. And maybe it was even during the days of unleavened bread. I would speculate it was possibly during the days of unleavened bread. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. This is called a Yom Tov in Hebrew, a good day. And in modern Hebrew, we call a holiday a Yom Tov. Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David. So he didn't even demand any specific amount. He just said, please, you have it in your power to help us. We're refugees. We're down and out. We helped you. We didn't charge you for the help. Please help us now. So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David and waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. So he was saying, yeah, we live in rebellious times, and David is just one more, you know, delinquent, one more rebel who broke away from his master, you know, destabilizing society, etc. You could just imagine. I mean, probably this is a summary of what he said. So just including David in with other criminals. David is like just as a, like another criminal. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who I do not know where they are from? Well, yeah, you don't know where they're from, but you know that they're connected to David. You know that they helped you out. So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and they told them all these words. So they had been rebuffed, rather clearly rebuffed. Now David, unfortunately, did have a temper and did at times lose control, even though he was a very righteous man. He was a devout man. He was just the psalmist, the sweet singer of Israel, as you know from other parts of the Bible. He was the ancestor of Jesus Christ. But he did have a violent streak, and as you know, he did not build the temple. God said, you gather the resources and Solomon will build it, a man of peace. David was a man of war, David in this case blew it. But you know, there are times when I think you can see in your life where God stepped in and perhaps saved you from a very embarrassing situation, where if things had gone on and followed their natural course, you would have really had cause for great embarrassment and shame. And maybe there are times when you came very close to doing the wrong thing, but God intervened in such a way that the temptation was removed, or something happened to kind of, oh yeah, no, I better not go that route. You know, that probably would be unwise after all. Maybe somebody said something to you. I remember even when I was a youngster, I was going to do something wrong. And at that time, fortunately, I had some positive peer pressure. I had some friends who were, you know, frankly, self-righteous. They were rather, what's the right word, holier than thou. But in this case, it was good that they were, because they warned me. They said, you shouldn't do that. And they were right, and I didn't. And it actually affected my conduct for years afterwards. So I was very grateful for their rebuke, even though, as I said, they had their problems, their ego. But in that case, you know, their presence there kept me from doing something that if I had done it, I would be ashamed. It would bother me to this day. My family can tell you, you know, what I do when I make a mistake, it gnaws at me, it gnaws at me. And that's one reason why every once in a while we need to realize, if we've repented of our sins, if we've been baptized, you know, if we've become part of the church, then those sins are not, you know, God is not remembering those sins. We need to remind ourselves once in a while of that. But I believe all of you can think of times when you merely, you know, really made a very big mistake, and somehow were protected. And that's what happened with David here. David was going to go overboard and punish this man who was, you know, definitely a wicked man, but he was going to not only punish the man, he was going to wipe out the man's staff, you know, reduce him to poverty. And therefore his wife in that sense would have been reduced to poverty, etc. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword. And David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything, as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. Verse 16. They were a wall to us, both by night and day, all the time we were with them, keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel that no one can speak to him. He was a Ben-Belial, a son of worthlessness. He was a biblical SOB, son of Belial. For he is such a scoundrel, right, that no one can speak to him. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread. So it may be that, I don't know if it's unleavened or not, so it may not have been that season to me, but it was probably spring, but it may not have been those 7 days. So I could be that they were leavened, could be not. But anyway, that was just speculation on my part, so in any case. The reason it was a good day was not because it was necessarily a holy day. He doesn't use the term for an appointed time or a holy day. He just says it's a good day, and I think it's because they were shearing the sheep and partying over that. So it may have just been, you know, a local festival of shearing of the sheep. Just a, you know, you can have local holidays, local festivals that are not commanded. You know, each nation has its own holidays. We recently had Thanksgiving in America. We have 4th of July in America, so this Yom Tov, this good day, could have just been something that they did locally at the time of the sheep shearing. Anyway, verse 18. But on the other hand, she made haste to do it. Aha! So maybe it was unleavened, because she did it in haste. So go back to my speculation. Anyway, then Abigail made haste and took 200, well, maybe they were already made. She could have had them on hand. So that's an argument the other way. See, I'm being a Talmudist here. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, you know, pressed figs together, and loaded them on donkeys. So she, quite a lot of, very generous, is of course what her husband should have done. And she said to her servants, go on before me, see I'm coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Now she was acting in such a way as to save his life. He was a very rough and wicked man, very selfish, and yet she was his wife. He was her husband. She was determined to save his life at the risk of her own. At the risk of her own. Because David was angry, and you know, when you're angry like that, you might take it out on the woman too. Or on the staff, on the people who, you know, who were there, you know. They were, in effect, risking their necks going out there. Verse 20. So it was as she rode on the donkey that she went down under cover of the hill, and there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow had in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. I helped him out. And I did, you know, I didn't do it for a fee. I did it. I wanted to be nice to the man. This is the kind of person David was. David and his people were doing good. They were, you know, they were do-gooders or good, you know, doers of good, you know. And as I said, even though they were refugees themselves, they were considered criminals by the king, but they were actually saints. Although many of his men had rough backgrounds and so on, but he was leading them, so now they were conforming to his standards, which were very strict. Even though he had a group of men around him, many of whom were vagabonds, but they were now under his discipline. Verse 22. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David. If I leave anyone that pisses against the wall. This is what he said literally. I don't know, for some reason the translations don't want to literally translate it. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David. If I leave anyone who pisses against the wall who belonged to him by morning light. In other words, any male. He's going to kill all the males. Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. Now let's understand You have to understand the position that you are in, and you have to be wise, and you have to work within the constraints that you have. You know, you have to play with the deck that you have been dealt, with which you have been dealt. In that culture, particularly, you know, men were very dominant over women in that culture. But even in general, you know, men and women have to operate differently because of just of their general characteristics and the way society tends to operate at any time in history. Think about Esther when she went to the king, how careful she was, how carefully she worded everything, you know, how she knew her place, but at the same time stepped out, risked her life. She was bold, but at the same time very careful in how she worded what she said, so that the idea is not to antagonize the other person. The idea is not to show what a great person you are, how courageous and bold you are. The idea is to accomplish the purpose. What's the purpose? Now, I'll tell you a story, and I'll couch it so that I'm not too specific. But there was one time a powerful minister, and he had the power in his church to affect doctrine. And there was he had made an error. He had made a mistake. And the idea was, let's get together, we scholars. I was not involved, but I know the story. So the scholar said, let's get together, we scholars, and convince this powerful leader to make this doctrinal change. Well, one of the scholars wrote a really rough letter, which would have provoked a reaction, you know, because sometimes you get that way, even though you shouldn't. We're all just, you know, everybody's just a human being. As we say about men, every man puts his pants on one leg at a time. You know, we're all just people. And this powerful leader, if he had gotten this letter, he would have possibly doubled down and said, oh yeah, I'm the one who's the leader, and God has made me the leader. And, you know, he might have reacted and then might have doubled down and kept the error going. Just, you know, in order to protect his position. Because he had been treated with such disrespect. Well, what they did is that they didn't send that letter to him. That's not the letter he saw. Rather, he saw a much better presentation, and in fact, the change was made. So what's more important, to get points across? You know, to say, yeah, you sure, you're overbearing, and you're this, and you're that. You shouldn't, like with David. David, you shouldn't lose your temper. Who do you think you are? No, the point is to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. What is she trying to accomplish? Number one, saving her husband's life and the life of the staff. And number two, quite frankly, saving David's reputation too. She admired David. How could you not admire David? They all admired David. That's why Saul was so jealous of him. She admired David, and she didn't want David to ruin his reputation and to sin in this way. It would be a sin to do this, to blow off like that. He was offended, but offense should not be a capital crime. So she was saving her husband and his staff, but also saving David and his reputation. Now when we read about it, we read about what David didn't do. This is not one of David's sins. This is one of the times when he was caught and prevented. Verse 23. Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. See, that's how she started. So she fell at his feet and said, oh, on me, my lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. She was willing, as his wife, to somehow take responsibility. She didn't want her husband to be blamed. Please let not my lord regard the scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. You know, Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. You know, so she took the meaning of fool and applied it to him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. You know, so maybe she's saying, look, had I been there, I would have calmed him down. I might have been able to influence him. You know, so I was wrong. I should have somehow been there. I should have known about it. I should have dealt with it. I should have convinced him. She's sort of taking the blame on herself in a way. Now, therefore, my lord, as the Eternal lives and as your soul lives, since the Eternal has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my lord be as Nabal. In other words, they'll have the same reputation as he has. Everybody knows he's a skinflint, he's miserly, he's selfish, he's boorish, you know. what shall I compare him to? Archie Bunker, if you used to watch that program in the 70s, or maybe Ebenezer Scrooge before his repentance, whatever it is. And so they're going to have the same reputation as he has. They're going to be looked down upon in history, as scoundrels. Those who oppose you. And now, this present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Okay? We're taking care of the problem. We are going to take care of your people. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Eternal will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house. So this is a prophecy. In fact, of course, as you know, David is the ancestor of the Messiah. David himself will be resurrected in the millennium and rule over the nation of all the 12 tribes of Israel. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Eternal will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Eternal, and evil is not found in you throughout your days. So she knew who David was, and she wanted to keep him from, you know, sullying his reputation. Who knows, you know, what might have happened historically if he had gone ahead with this. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living. This phrase is found on tombstones in cemeteries throughout the Hebrew-speaking world, this particular phrase, you know, that may the life be bound in the bundle of the living. This Hebrew phrase is found on tombstones. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Eternal your God, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling. Isn't that clever? She refers to the sling. That was a very proud moment in his life when he slew Goliath. So she's referring back to that. So she knew what she was doing. And it shall come to pass when the Eternal has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief in you, to you. You see, you're not going to have to think back on this hideous episode where you blew your top and got violent and took people's lives over this. No, it's not going to be part of your past. That this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Eternal has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. So she says, keep me in mind later on. Maybe she felt like maybe her husband would eventually drive her out, or maybe he was a good bit older than she was. Maybe he would eventually die before she did, or maybe he was sickly. Or maybe she just wanted to make sure that she was dealt with properly, you know, and through her husband and her household as a result. Obviously, she's not going to ask him to deal well with Nabal. So she's going to say, do well with me. And in that sense, she's doing well with Nabal. So in that sense, she's protecting her husband because of her reputation. In other words, David had a great admiration for this woman, and because of that, would therefore also bless her husband. You could imagine that. You know, there's a certain movie that comes to mind. There was this woman that everybody, you know, really, really loved. And her boyfriend needed help. And then many of them came to his help because they loved her so much. And I guess that's what she's saying here. You know, in other words, I do this with my students a lot. I kid around with my students. These are immigrants coming to America, and I teach them English. And then I say to them, you're going to go on to become rich and famous. And when you do, remember your English instructor. And they always tell me that they will. Well, let's see what happens. Is it going to be like Joseph, like the butler that forgot him? Maybe someday they'll remember me, huh, when they're very old. Oh, yeah, that English teacher. How is he doing now? Anyway. That this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Eternal has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. Then David said to Abigail, blessed is the Eternal God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. This is divine providence. This is God's intervention. He inspired Abigail. He's inspired David. You know, he allowed David to see the seamier side of himself. So that's good, right? Sometimes it's good for you to see that you have a seamier side. You think you don't? You do. We all do. So David got to see his seamier side, but fortunately he got a hold of himself through this woman. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. So now he realized, yeah, it was wrong. It would have been wrong to do this. For indeed, as the eternal God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to me surely by morning light, nobody who pisses against the wall would have been left to Nabal. Now, maybe in the Hollywood version, that's what they'll have. Probably a lot worse. I don't know. Verse 35. So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have heeded your voice and respected your person. So just like Esther in later years, she intervened and saved her people in that sense, her husband, his staff, and David's reputation and the reputation of his people. Now Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was holding a feast in the house, in his house, you know, very indulgent, you know, pigging out, we could say. Mm-hmm. Like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So we see another aspect of his character. Therefore, she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light. So it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him. So he was utterly shocked, perhaps for a couple of reasons. Number one, what she had done, and maybe number two, how close he came to being exterminated. So in any case, he was just so shocked that he evidently had cardiac arrest. So it was in the morning when wine had gone from Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him and became like a stone. So he just died. Now, maybe he very likely was well overweight and maybe hadn't the healthiest of diets, you know, very indulgent person. He seemed to have been an alcoholic, perhaps. I'm just speculating. But he died suddenly. Now, I'm going to say another thing along these lines. That is often what happens in situations like this. If you don't take the law into your own hands, if you try to be godly and do the right thing and follow the scriptures, then God will intervene in very dramatic ways and take care of the issues that are bothering you. You've got a boss that's a pain in the neck. Hang in there. You'll see that eventually that boss will not be there. It might even be a boss will be promoted. You know, the boss may not be that bad. Maybe that boss just has some issue with you. So maybe instead of the boss, you know, leaving or being fired, maybe the boss will be promoted, but at least the boss won't have to deal with the boss anymore. So God has his ways of intervening where we don't have to sort of take the issue into our own hands and do the wrong thing and to be involved in politics, in some of these things that people do, conspiracies. You know, let's not get involved in conspiracies. Let's just do our work and do the best we can and look to God if, as I said, if we have an unreasonable situation, to intervene and to work it out. And that's what happened. God intervened. Abigail came, brought the food to David. Nabal, who was so wicked, quickly dies. And so that David has an additional reward, as you'll see in a minute. Not only does he have all the food, but Nabal's not there anymore. And because Nabal's not there anymore, more happens that all of you know about, I guess, but I'll read about it. Then it happened after about 10 days that the Eternal struck Nabal and he died. Okay, so he became like a stone then. He didn't die right then. I'm sorry. He became like a stone right then. You know, he's silent, quiet, didn't know what to do. But 10 days later he died. So he didn't die right then, but he was very shocked at what happened. And we don't know entirely. Probably, as I said, there are several reasons why he was so shocked. One, because she had given all that material to David, but secondly, because he came so close to being killed and all his staff. So it was just a shocking thing. He didn't know what to say, so he came like a stone. But then 10 days later, he died. For whatever reason, we don't know. But, you know, God has a way of dealing with people and dealing with events. We have to realize he is in control. He is in control. He is on his throne. And if we do the right thing, then we have to look to him to intervene where we're not able to deal with situations. If they're beyond our power to deal with them, and they're not beyond God's power to deal with. So then it happened after about 10 days that the Eternal struck Nabal and he died. So 10 days later. So meantime, David had his food. David's men were taken care of. David was going on with his life. But then he hears that Nabal has died. So when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Eternal who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal. So he took this as divine intervention. A wicked man has been dealt with. this man had done wickedly to David, who was the anointed of the Eternal, the one that Samuel had anointed to be king. A man who had done righteously for him, who had protected his flock, his property. And so in David's mind, God had intervened and dealt with Nabal. So in effect, David didn't have to take his life. God saw to it that his life was taken. So when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Eternal, who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept his servant from evil." See, I didn't do anything. I'm not blamed for this. "For the Eternal has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own head." And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. Now he had her as a wife. And David at that time was doing what was culturally acceptable in that period of time, especially for people who had power and influence. People of power and influence in those days, monarchs, were polygamous, and he was. But, you know, in those days, women needed some kind of protection. Women did need to be associated with a male, either their elder brother or their dad, or in this case, a husband. And she was beautiful, and she was virtuous, and she was courageous. She was, you know, she was Proverbs 31. You know, there she is. And so it was legal for him to marry her, and he did. When the servants of David had come to Abigail, well, first he proposed to her, for now we have to have her accept, right? And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. What do you suppose she said? When the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her saying, "David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife." Now she had been faithful to Nabal, and she had even risked her life to save him, but now he was dead. Now she was a widow, and David had proposed to her. Then she arose, bowed her face to the earth, and said, "Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." Still, that humility. Wow. So you see the kind of person that she was, as Jesus said. You know, this is the kind of people we should be. In a few months, we're going to have a foot washing ceremony. So we're going to remind ourselves that that is the attitude that we should have. So Abigail rose in haste, you know, as she wanted to do this, of course. So Abigail rose in haste and rode on a donkey, attended by five of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. And so she was able to, and she had children. Later on, I think you'll see in the genealogies, there was a child that she had. I think in one of the genealogies, he actually has the name Daniel. He has a different name in another genealogy. One of the names of her son was Daniel, I believe. Maybe I should check that out. See, 1 Chronicles 2:16. 1 Chronicles 2:16. Well, it mentions here that Abigail bore Amasa. So we do have we do have one of the people here that's coming from Abigail is Amasa, but let me go if I can find 2 Samuel 17. Mentions Amasa again. So the Daniel part, I guess I made a mistake with that. But Amasa was a child of Abigail. Okay, so Abigail did at least give him that child, and was married to him. So she was rewarded by marrying into the royal line, into the messianic line. And she's mentioned in the genealogy. She's mentioned here, and she's mentioned in the genealogies. So I want to reflect back on these three women, of valor, Proverbs 31 women, who showed faith, who showed courage, who represent qualities that, you know, that we need to emulate as the collective bride of Jesus Christ, Deborah, Yael, and Abigail. I want to remember these wonderful women and their example. And we can go back now, and now that I've brought this to your attention, you can go back and study further into their lives. And if you have any input, you know, you can give me some of this input, and we can deal with it in the Q&A next time. I'll try to follow through and do some more genealogical research and comment on it in the Q&A next time, or before I get into my subject next time. I'd like to now go to the end of the Bible, to the book of Revelation. We know that the church is pictured as the bride of Christ. The church is pictured as the virtuous woman. False religious systems are pictured by the fallen woman there in Revelation 17, and by Jezebel and other imagery. And the church is pictured as the virtuous woman. I want to go to Revelation 22. And here we see, as we come to the end of the story, that the bride of Christ is so eager, you know, for the marriage to take place, for the groom to return. I remember one time I was doing a wedding in Wichita, Kansas, and I was there, and the bride was there. She came from Wichita, but the groom was living in Southern California, and he had to arrive for the wedding to take place. So I said, well, this is just like the church awaiting the return of Jesus Christ. So he was very flattered that I made that comparison. But I was there in Wichita, the bride was there in Wichita, and he was coming from California so that I could perform the ceremony there. So that's the situation here. So in Revelation 22 and verse 17, Revelation 22 and verse 17, and the Spirit and the bride say, come. You know, so the Spirit of God is saying to the Logos, to the Word of God, to, you know, to the Son of God, come. You know, this is, so we're inspired by God's Spirit to pray for the coming of Jesus Christ. But notice who else says come, the bride. You know, so as I said, the church, the Spirit says come, and the bride is inspired by the Spirit to say come. So God wants to come, and we want God to come, but he's doing it on a timetable that he only knows. We don't know, he knows it. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. Right? So all of you who hear, but that the bride is supposed to say, come, you know, you're part of the bride, so you pray your kingdom come. Matthew 6:10. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. And let him who thirsts come, whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. So we are certainly looking forward to the coming of Jesus Christ, to the consummation of the marriage. We as collectively the bride of Christ are looking forward to the coming of our bridegroom, our hero, Jesus Christ. And in the meantime, let's remember these wonderful women. Well, I thank you very much for your interest. And as I said, I want to do further research into the genealogies, and I'll comment on that next week. If anybody has any questions or input on what I covered today or on anything else, then please interact with us. We have a Facebook page. We have a Q&A section you can email to, or you can email to the church mail or to me, or even call. Some of you are able to do that. And we can continue the discussion. But I do appreciate giving this material over today. I was very excited about covering this material today, and hope that it was of value to those of you who heard it, and those of you who will also hear it later on. So until next time, all the best to you and yours.